Chapter 7, Race and Intelligence. It was easy for me to understand why the egalitarians were opposed to the studies showing that IQ is mostly hereditary, for it turns out that blacks usually do very poorly on IQ tests. The natural inference is that if IQ is primarily inherited, and blacks have dramatically lower IQs, then the differences between the races are likely to be genetic. I learned that there are hundreds of studies documenting IQ differences between blacks and whites. Dr. Audrey Shuey, in her comprehensive work, The Testing of Negro Intelligence, compiled more than 300 different IQ studies comparing black and white intelligence. They found that average black IQ scores are between 15 and 20 points lower than white averages. In scientific terms, they vary between 1 and 1.5 standard deviations, SD, below whites. The fact that dramatic IQ differences exist between blacks and whites can also be illustrated by the fact that black activist groups have outlawed ability groupings in many schools, claiming that it resegregates the schools. In California, it is even forbidden to use IQ tests to aid in the selection of students who would benefit from special classes for the mentally retarded. A courageous black mother sued the state in an attempt to overturn the law so that her retarded child could get the remedial help she needed. In the Larry P. versus Wilson Riles case, the judge ruled that the tests were biased simply because more blacks attained very low scores. Thus, in the state of California, it became official policy that the tests, along with ability groupings in education, are racist and forbidden merely because black performance is substantially lower than that of whites. The case affords an excellent example of how efforts to artificially equalize the races can harm both whites and blacks. I must stress that comparisons between white and black scores are of averages between the groups. Because blacks as a group score lower in IQ than whites does not mean that there are not some individual blacks who score in the highest category and some whites who score in the lowest. However, when one contrasts the overlapping bell-shaped curves of IQ performance by race and looks at the black-white difference at different levels, it becomes obvious that race difference becomes more pronounced at the high end and the low end of extremes of the distribution. For example, 1/2 of all blacks score in the lowest 1/4 of whites. On the high end of the scale, an IQ of at least 115 is considered necessary for excellent college work or for the top managerial and professional jobs in America. Only about 2.5% of blacks score that high as compared to about 16% of whites. About 20 times more whites than blacks per capita have IQs over 130, and somewhere between 50 and 100 times more whites are in the above 140 IQ range. This is the IQ group that many psychologists believe is responsible for most of the greatest achievements of civilization. Black representation at the low scoring end of the IQ scale has even stronger implications for society. See my text for the charts that accompany this. They're very revealing, and it shows you the shape of the bell curve, the curve that looks like a bell, which means there's a lot more deviation at the ends of the spectrum, whether it be white or black, high or low. At least 25% of blacks are below 75 in IQ, and an IQ in the 70 to 75 range is classified as borderline retarded by most psychologists. Practically no one in that IQ range will graduate from high school or even learn much of elementary school basics. None will qualify for the armed forces, and few will be able to find good employment. And in my book, I show many sources for that data. After learning the truth about racial differences in IQ and going public with it, for years I faced media condemnation as a racist for daring to say that 20% of blacks had IQs below 75. in October 1994, many years after my first statements on the matter. Newsweek magazine did a cover story on the release of The Bell Curve, the groundbreaking book on IQ and racial differences. Newsweek, matter-of-factly, stated that 25% rather than 20% of blacks fell into that lowest category. It took 24 years, but I had been eclipsed in my radical racial opinions by Newsweek. The article went on to flatly assert, quote, if blacks are inferior to whites as a group, the dream of a truly integrated society is dead. Even back in 1964, science had established the stark facts of white-black IQ differences, but the media chose not to report these facts. In an analysis of 11 large studies of black-white IQ differences, Arthur Jensen showed that there's a strong correlation between black-white gap on mental tests and the degree to which the tests accurately measure G, intelligence. That's for general intelligence related to abstract reasoning and problem-solving ability. Blacks do relatively well on tests of rote memory, memorization of sequences of numbers or letters, but that correlates very little with G. The popular media swept the facts under the rug, and the liberal psychologists argue that IQ doesn't really measure or mean anything. And then they added, as a precaution, in case someone believed it did mean something, that IQ tests are culturally biased against blacks. The next section, are mental tests biased against blacks? When I began discussing the black-white IQ differences with my teachers and friends, I often heard the chitterlings' explanation of low black IQ scores. Chitterlings. IQ tests were said to reflect white culture and therefore put blacks at a disadvantage. For instance, they argue that if white kids were asked questions about chitlins, the small intestines of pigs cooked and eaten as food by many blacks, they would do poorly as black kids who are asked questions that use terms such as tennis. In desperation, some egalitarian psychologists have even argued that black children would do better with testing in black English. Some went so far as to try to design tests that would purposefully improve black performance. But guess what? When whites took these same tests, they still scored much higher than blacks. Also contradicting the cultural bias or chitterlings explanation for low black IQ are studies showing that Hispanics, who on average are poorer than blacks and who have obvious language and cultural handicaps, many being new arrivals to our culture, they score significantly higher than blacks in the abstract sections of IQ tests. They consistently score higher in the verbal sections as well. American Indians, who in comparison with blacks are poorer and generally more isolated from mainstream American culture and education centers, also do better than blacks on IQ tests. Arthur Jensen in Bias and Mental Testing, a very fine study, wrote, quote, on a composite level of 12 SES socioeconomic status and other environmental indices, the American Indian population ranks about as far below black standards as blacks rank below that of whites. But it turns out that Indians score higher than blacks on tests of intelligence. On a nonverbal reasoning test given in the first grade, before schooling could have had much impact, Indian children exceeded the mean score of blacks by the equivalent of 14 IQ points. Opposite from what one would predict from the theory that ethnic group differences in IQ merely reflect SES, socioeconomic status differences. Blacks consistently, this is my words again, do better on the parts of the IQ test that have the largest cultural component and poorest on the parts that were the most culture free. Blacks do far better on the verbal parts of IQ tests than they do on parts with symbols measuring abstract mental abilities. If cultural bias is responsible for differences in black and white IQ scores, then the biggest gap, obviously, should be in the more culturally loaded verbal tests. But the opposite is true. Again, documented by major studies in my text. In more recent years, mechanical reaction time tests also show strong evidence that IQ tests are not culturally biased against blacks. Arthur Jensen and others have found that mechanical speed of decision-making correlates strongly with IQ. In these tests, subjects sit before a series of lights and respond to which one comes on first. The speed of mental reaction strongly correlates with IQ test scores and is higher for white and Asian children than for blacks. One would be hard-pressed to understand how reaction time to a flashing light could be culturally biased. I learned that written IQ tests actually tend to overrate black mental abilities because a significant portion of most IQ tests are verbal with a heavy reliance on memory and experience rather than abstract reasoning and problem solving. If the tests were able to isolate spatial reasoning ability, the gap would grow even wider. If an IQ test, SAT, Scholastic Aptitude Test, or Armed Forces Qualification Test, AFQT, is biased against a certain group, it would not accurately predict that group's performance. For instance, if blacks would score lower than whites in IQ, but do better in school than their IQs would suggest, this would indicate that the tests were not accurately assessing black ability and indicate a bias against blacks. The reality is that IQ tests do quite well in predicting the performance of blacks and whites as a group. Actually, the college SAT tests have a bias somewhat against whites in that whites do slightly better in college than the tests indicate, and blacks do slightly worse. It's unlikely that test designers intentionally bias tests in favor of blacks, for if they knew how to do that, they would do more of it. Some blacks with relatively high IQs often lack other character factors to do well at some life activities. The most prestigious scientific body in America, the National Academy of Sciences, through its research arm, the National Research Council, investigated whether there is test bias against blacks in IQ and other intelligence-based tests such as SAT. And this is what the National Academy of Sciences stated, quote, at the undergraduate college level, the equation for white students has usually been found to result either in predicted grades for blacks that tend to be about equal to the grades they actually achieve or somewhat better than the grades they actually achieve. The results do not support the notion that the traditional use of scores in a prediction equation yields predictions for blacks that systematically underestimate their actual performance. If anything, there is some indication of the converse. Unquote. Finding that the tests are biased against whites, albeit modestly, illustrates once again that the truth of the matter is exactly opposite of what the popular mass media regularly tells Americans. The black-white difference is not a result of the test cultural bias or discrimination. It is real. Next section, black IQ is markedly lower, but as the studies of marked IQ differences between races increasingly mounted in the scientific community, racial egalitarians retreated to new ground. Many of them abandoned the IQ is meaningless and tests are biased arguments. They suggested that if blacks had lower IQs than whites, which had become patently undeniable, it was simply because they grew up in deprived environments. The egalitarians blamed socioeconomic factors such as poverty and low parental education levels for low black IQ scores. However, many studies of blacks and whites take socioeconomic factors into account. And these also consistently find that even those blacks who come from high income and well-educated families still, on average, have markedly lower IQs than whites. SAT scores correlate very highly with IQ, and the testing service has gathered information on the parental income, education, and race of its test takers. They've been trying to make a strong effort to make sure the tests aren't biased against blacks by assembling this data. And if the tests are biased, they definitely want to remedy that. it finds that black students with a household income of more than $70,000 a year and who have at least one parent who is a college graduate score lower on the SAT test than whites from households that make less than $20,000 annually and in which both parents are high school dropouts. The most environmentally disadvantaged group of whites who take the SAT score higher than the most environmentally advantaged group of blacks. The psychological data for genetic explanations for poor black performance in IQ are extensive and powerful. IQ studies, including blacks, whites, and Asians, have extensively correlated many socioeconomic factors, including family income, parental education level, and occupation status, and school quality. Groups of low-income whites with low parental education levels and low parental occupation statuses constantly score higher in IQ than blacks from families of high income, high education levels, and high occupation status. Next section, the harm of ignoring racial differences. The argument that environmental conditions cause the difference in IQ levels between the races admits that a real difference exists. If there is a real difference in the IQs of black children and white children, for whatever reason, it certainly suggests the ending of forced school integration, for it is far better for children to group in line with their own natural abilities. A good example of the harm caused by ignoring IQ differences could be found in the classroom that has a very bright and very slow-learning child side by side. The instruction is bound to be too challenging for the mentally slower child who cannot keep up and thus becomes utterly lost and frustrated. On the other hand, the teaching will be too slow to challenge the bright child whose potential goes untapped. If such mental differences in the classroom fall along racial lines, one can imagine how tensions and ill will can develop between the diverse groups. Even though races are clearly different in learning ability, the government operates on the false premise of equality. When California outlawed affirmative action in its college entrance programs, there was a dramatic decline in black and Mexican acceptance in the best academic schools. Egalitarians bewailed the results as unfair to blacks and Mexicans. But what the lower minority numbers actually prove is that better qualified whites had been grievously discriminated against. It has been more than 80 years since the first IQ studies were conducted involving both whites and blacks. In the 1990s, black scores were the same IQ in relation to whites as they had in the 1920s, about 15 to 20 points lower. For 70 years, standards of living, education, and employment opportunities have dramatically improved for blacks, and they have been accompanied by massive school and social integration. Yet, dramatic socioeconomic improvement has not raised black IQ scores in relation to those of whites. The evidence is also clear that the IQ gap has not been narrowed by increasing educational stimulation in the black child's early years or by publicly integrated schooling. If there is any effect at all, it has only widened the gap. The multi-billion-dollar Head Start preschool environmental enrichment program, maintained primarily to help blacks compete educationally, has resulted in no gains by black students, but a little gain by whites. An extensive and excellent study was done by J. Curry and D. Thomas showing Head Start's abject failure. Head Start is the most expensive and widespread program to raise the educational performance of disadvantaged youths. Next section, the SCAR study. Genetic origins of lower black intelligence can also be seen in a number of studies that chart proportional black ancestry. One of the first major studies was done as early as 1916 in Virginia. Large groups of black children were divided into groups determined by the number of white and black grandparents, and the black subjects, pure or partially black, were raised in the black community's environment. All blacks, no matter whether they have 1/10 white blood or 100% black blood, they are raised together in the South, certainly in those periods. Now, the blacks with four black grandparents scored the lowest in IQ. Blacks with three black grandparents and one white, a bit higher. Blacks with two white grandparents, higher still. And blacks with three white grandparents scored highest in IQ among the black children. The most recent studies of the 1990s show precisely the same results. One of the most powerful direct studies of race and environment was conducted by psychologists Sandra Scar, Richard Weinberg, and I.D. Waldman. All three are quite well known for their environmentalist opinions. The study analyzed white, black, and mixed race adopted children in more than 100 white families in Minnesota. The study was an egalitarian's dream because the children's adoptive parents had prestigious levels of income and education, and were anti-racist enough to adopt a black child into their own family. Scar is a strong defender of racial equality and maintained that environment played an almost exclusive role in IQ differences between the races. Scar supports the importance of heredity in causing individual differences within a race, but she has argued, at least previously, that the between-race differences are mostly environmental. Now, the children in the study included adopted whites, blacks, and mulattoes, as well as the biological children of the white adoptive couples. At the age of 7, the children were tested for IQ, and all the groups, including the blacks and mulattoes, scored above average in IQ. Scar and Weinberg published a paper claiming to have proven the almost exclusive power of environment over race and IQ, even though they had to admit that the white children, whether adopted or not, scored well above the black and mulatto children, and that the mulatto children scored above the blacks. A decade later, when the children reached the age of 17, a follow-up study was conducted and again included IQ measurements. As they matured, black children had dropped back to an average of 89 in IQ, which is the average IQ for blacks in the region, in that region of the United States, where the study was done. The white adopted children scored an average of 106 in IQ, 17 points higher than the black children, which is consistent with the traditional studies of black and white IQ differences. In line with genetic theory, the half-white, half-black mulatto adopted children scored almost exactly between the adopted whites and blacks. Parental IQ, 115.35 on average. Biological children, 109.4. White adopted children, 105.6. Mulatto parents adopted children, 98.5. Black parents adopted children, 89.4. Scar and Weinberg reluctantly published their data from the follow-up survey, but they waited close to 4 years to do so, almost as if they were embarrassed by what they found. Through a tortured reasoning progress, they still argued that environment played a dominant role in IQ, but their follow-up survey, unlike their first paper, also admitted that genes had an important aspect as well. Both Richard Lynn and Michael Levin effectively showed in their reanalysis of Scar's own data that genes clearly comprise the dominant role in intelligence levels of those adopted children. Next section is African IQ studies. Genetic tests indicate that almost all American blacks have some white genes, while only 1% of whites have black genes. Again, it's documented in my book by major scientific research, fairly recent. This probably occurred because American society classified every person with any degree of black blood as a Negro and strictly segregated them. IQ scores in Africa, where they are presumably more purely black, are even lower. As American blacks are one standard deviation below whites in IQ by 85, pure blacks in Africa of equal schooling with whites average about two standard deviations below whites below 75. Professor Richard Lynn compiled studies in 1991 of IQ in Africa, where there is far less white genetic addition to the black gene pool than in the United States. He found that sub-Sahara African blacks have an IQ below 75, which is almost two standard deviations below the white norm. By European standards, these figures mean that approximately 50% of black Africans could be classified as borderline mentally retarded or below. That's almost twice the rate of blacks in the United States. Since Lynn's review in 1991, three newer studies have confirmed his work. They used Raven progressive matrices, a non-cultural specific test that is an accurate measurement of nonverbal general intelligence. A black Zimbabwean, Fred Zindi, conducted one of the studies which compared 204 Zimbabwean 12 to 14-year-olds and matched them to 202 English students for sex, educational level, and class background. English students scored an average of IQ of about 97, while blacks of comparable educational background averaged 70 in IQ. And again, we have the charts and the data and a lot of footnotes on this issue in the text. Next section, attempts to refute the significance of race. A few studies have purported to prove that with the right environmental stimuli, black children would develop IQs similar to those of white and Asian children. The Milwaukee Project was the most famous of these, and inevitably it attracted plentiful media coverage in its heyday. It was reported that through intensive early childhood intervention and stimulation, underprivileged, slum-dwelling black children had their IQs increased 30 points in comparison with the control group. The Washington Post wrote triumphantly that the project's success settled once and for all the question of whether kids of poor socioeconomic backgrounds are held back by environment or heredity. Unfortunately for the egalitarians, their euphoric media bubble burst when the Milwaukee Project's director, Rick Haber, was convicted and imprisoned for embezzling government money. While this is not directly relevant to the results of the project, it does call into question the trustworthiness of its director. Howard L. Garber, longtime associate of Haber, in 1988 issued a report on the project that revealed the IQ gains were artificial, having been achieved by intensive practice on problems similar to those on the Stanford-Binet test, and that the kids' IQs declined steadily after leaving the program, with the gains never translating into academic success. Ultimately, their abilities matched at the same level as that of the control group, which, of course, had no intervention. Documentation in my hard text. Herman Spitz, in his book, The Raising of Intelligence, documents dozens of similar programs that failed miserably to raise the IQs of blacks. In their initial stages, the media gave them extensive coverage and rave reviews, but little coverage of their ultimate failures. The pattern of publicity is identical to that under Lysenkoism in the Soviet Union. Over the years, there were many media blitzes proclaiming the remarkable success of various early intervention programs. With embarrassing regularity, the touted programs were allowed to sink into quiet disrepute while the media trumpeted the miraculous results of another new approach. More documents in the text. Another example of media proof that black-white differences are environmental is the coverage of Chicago black teacher Marva Collins. One of the most famous personalities in American education, Collins has gotten extensive media coverage, including adulatory articles in the New York Times and sumptuous praise on the television show 60 Minutes. She claimed that seemingly unteachable inner-city children between 5 and 10 years old had soared in standardized tests using her teaching methods and were reading and comprehending Tolstoy, Plato, and Shakespeare. In spite of such incredible claims, the media never asked Collins for hard scientific evidence to substantiate her assertions. nor has her miracle been successfully duplicated by any other psychologists and educators in controlled studies. These kinds of miraculous stories, ever popular in the mass media, for a good reason, never find their way into the scrutiny afforded by scientific journals. Next section, a forbidden subject. The white-black IQ gap is forbidden knowledge in the public realm. In 1986, the American Psychological Association seriously debated whether all research on black-white differences should be banned. Much earlier, in 1962, the American Association of Physical Anthropologists voted on censoring the very book that began my search for the racial truth, Race and Reason. Before taking the vote, the eminent president of the association, Dr. Carlton Kuhn, asked for a show of hands of who at the meeting had actually read the book. Only two or three hands went up. When the association approved the censure resolution, Kuhn resigned his post in protest. Such Luddite deliberations should raise alarm bells in the minds of all those who seek the truth, for they're clearly reminiscent of the efforts of the church in the Middle Ages to ban astronomical research when it challenged religious notions of the structure of the universe. What kind of truth is it that must suppress its questioner? Scientific evidence of inherent racial differences is overwhelming and obvious. I could guess how Galileo or Copernicus felt when their tracking of the heavens convinced them that the sun did not revolve around the earth. The evidence was so clear that the sun is the center of the solar system that some clerics refused to look at it. One of the clerics in the controversy with Galileo, Cardinal Bellarmino, refused to look through the telescope because he said the devil would make him see things that Galileo said were there. A narrow-necked bottle that symbolized his narrow mind became known as the Bellarmino bottle. Bellarmino's bias is perfectly analogous to egalitarian true believers who refuse to look at the mountain of evidence that challenges their sacred creed. In the America of 1964, as in the America of today, there was no more degrading and damaging epithet than racist. The word was not used to mean a person who understands the realities of race. It was and is now a term associated with hatred, repression, and human brutality. As Galileo's facts of the solar system were equated with the devil, so today many facts of race are associated with Hitler. Yet for me, understanding inherent racial differences had nothing to do with hatred, and I sensed no hatred in the words of the objective scientists I read. They simply sought the truth. And so did a precocious 14-year-old boy reading in his room far into the night. Next section, what is prejudice? When I did my report explaining the arguments against racial integration of schools, a couple of my more liberal classmates accused me of being prejudiced and bigoted. Those words stung. I had no anger or hatred toward blacks or anyone else, and I could not understand why I should be called prejudiced just for researching and reporting on a particular scientific and political viewpoint. As I shared more of what I learned with anyone who would listen, classmates, teachers, neighbors, the word prejudice, hate, bigotry kept on coming up like a mantra. When I looked up prejudice and bigotry in the dictionary, I came to realize that my slanderers were guilty of the very offenses of which they accused me. Prejudge. To pass judgment on prematurely or without sufficient reflection or investigation. Prejudice. Unfavorable opinion or feeling formed beforehand or without knowledge, thought, or reason. Bigot. Noun. A person who is extremely intolerant of another's creed, belief, or opinion. In one common usage of the term prejudice, denotes an irrational hatred or dislike toward blacks or other racial groups, anyone who believes in racial differences, even if the bias for his belief is scientific and reasoned, finds himself branded with this pejorative term. Most egalitarians have prejudged an idea, inherent racial differences, as I once did before reading both sides, and they themselves are hatefully intolerant, bigoted, against those who differ with them. The press never applies the word prejudice to them. I came to realize that when I so fervently believed in racial equality, it was I who showed prejudice in the real sense of the word. For up to that time, because of the liberal press's bias, I had heard and learned only the pro-equality arguments. Until I read Race and Reason, I had read only pro-equality books and magazine and newspaper articles. And that's not counting the hundreds of television programs, movies, sermons, and speeches that I'd seen and heard that promoted egalitarian principles. I had prejudged the issue before hearing both sides. I was truly prejudiced. Most of those who call me bigoted and prejudiced had not read even one book or article questioning racial equality. They are simply not open-minded on the issue. Now, there is no doubt that some whites who are opposed to blacks are bigots. That is, they have a prejudice as to their beliefs and are intolerant of the opposition. But certainly, with the mass media presenting only one side of the racial equality argument, bigots are more likely to be found in the ranks of egalitarians. Even well-known scientists and public figures have faced great difficulty, even physical suppression, for expressing their opinions about racial differences. And I document this thoroughly in the text. In the academic community, no egalitarian scientists have been prevented from speaking. None have been assaulted by those who believe in racial differences. But racial freethinkers certainly have. It is ironic as well that the greatest support for black and white racial equality has been found in the whitest areas of America, and the greatest skepticism of it in the areas of the nation with the greatest black presence. I realize that those who personally experience few blacks, but judge them to be on average equal, and sometimes even superior to whites, prejudge them. While whites who live and work among many blacks form their opinion after having experienced them. Even though most Southern whites grew up with a constant stream of egalitarian media propaganda, just like those in the North, they more often weigh both sides of the issue before coming to believe in racial differences. They make what could be called an after judgment, not a prejudgment. Most racially egalitarians have good motives. I certainly did when I was a child, as a side note. They think that their position is enlightened, that it will bring goodness, and that God is on their side. But those are the same kinds of motivations that decreed Galileo's astronomy as a, quote, work of the devil, or the devil's hatred of God. In fact, the egalitarians have a special, emotionally charged word to describe those who question racial equality, and that word is hate. Egalitarians love to hate the haters. The ultimate word to describe belief in racial differences is racism. But the word racism is loaded because it's not defined as simply belief in inherent racial differences. In most dictionaries, it is also defined as, quote, usually involving the idea that one's own race is superior and has the right to rule others, unquote. And also as, quote, hatred and intolerance of another race or races. To understand that racial differences exist does not necessarily make one want to rule over or hate other races. It is similar to the use of the term heretic in the Middle Ages. Astronomers who realized that the sun rather than the earth is the center of the solar system were branded heretics because the book of Genesis seems to indicate that the earth is at the center. Of course, just because an astronomer believed in heliocentrism did not make him a hater of God any more than belief in racial differences makes one hate other races. In later years, in a survey of academics, the authors of the IQ controversy, the media and public policy, Snyderman and Rothman, found that 53% of respondents believed that both environment and genes caused the race differences. And again, I document this in the text. Quietly, over a period of 20 years, scores of leading researchers had come to the same opinion of scorned men, such as Carlton Putnam, William Shockley, and Arthur Jensen back in the 1960s. And I must say that the great biologist, the great discoverer of the DNA, also, Mr. Watson, has gotten to a great deal of trouble for simply stating what he believes to be the truth about genetic differences in intelligence between whites and blacks. Now, in this audio version, I will discuss the 10 areas of scientific evidence on black-white IQ difference that overwhelmingly show the difference in racial intelligence. Even in the 1960s, the evidence of difference in IQ among the races was overwhelming. Now, it is irrefutable. When the media says that racial differences don't exist, they might as well say the earth is flat. Recently, J. Philip Rushton teamed up with Arthur Jensen to examine 10 categories of scientific evidence from around the world published since Jensen's path-breaking 1969 paper in the Harvard Educational Review. Their 60-page review, 30 Years of Research on Race Differences in Cognitive Ability, was published as the lead article in the June 2005 issue of Psychology, Public Policy, and Law, a journal of the American Psychological Association, along with four responses, three critical and their own reply, which laid out their refutations of their critics in great detail. Rushton and Jensen concluded that the IQ differences were attributable more to differences in brain size than to racism, and that the genetic component was even higher than they had initially thought, likely about 80%. This confirms the default hypothesis laid out in Jensen's 1998 book, The G Factor, that by adulthood, genetic and cultural factors carry the exact same weight in causing the mean black-white IQ difference as they do in causing differences between individuals in IQ, about 80% genetic, 20% environmental. Here's a summary of the evidence they published. Number one, the worldwide pattern of IQ scores. Around the world, the average IQ for East Asian centers around 106, for whites about 100, for blacks about 85 in the United States, and only 70 in sub-Saharan Africa. The same rank order of race differences is found for culture-reduced tests and reaction time measures. Reaction time tasks are so easy that all children can do them in less than 1 second. More intelligent children, measured by conventional IQ tests, perform faster on these tasks. East Asians average faster reaction times than whites who have faster reaction times than blacks. Rushton even traveled to South Africa to collect new IQ data to corroborate the remarkably low test scores reported for the general African population, a mean IQ of 70. He tested IQ scores from highly selected black students at the prestigious university of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. These studies averaged an IQ of 84. Assuming that African university students are 15 IQ points above the population mean, as university students typically are, the findings of an average Rushton even traveled to South Africa to collect new IQ data to corroborate the remarkably low test scores reported for the general African population, mean IQ of 70. He tested IQ scores from highly selected black students at the prestigious University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. These studies average an IQ of 84, assuming that African university students are 15 IQ points above the population mean, as university students typically are. The findings of an average IQ of 84 corroborates the general population average of 70. This worldwide pattern contradicts the hypothesis that the low IQ of American blacks is due to white racism or to the legacy of slavery. Many of the African countries showing IQ equals 70, such as Nigeria and Ghana, have been independent for half a century, and the Caribbean island of Haiti for two centuries. There has been no documented improvement in cultural achievement or in IQ scores. Number two, race differences are most pronounced on the more G-loaded components of tests. Some test items load more on the G factor than do other, more culturally malleable items. A test's G-loading is the best predictor, not just of school grades and workplace performance, but also of all other indicators and correlates of intelligence, including biological variables such as brain size, reaction times, and heritability estimates as calculated from twin studies. Race differences are repeatedly found to be higher on more G-loaded tests. Three, blacks and whites regress toward their predicted and different averages. Basic genetic theory predicts that the IQ of offspring will regress toward the mean IQ of the population group from which the parents come. This has been amply documented for a number of physical traits in humans and in other species. Regression to the average is seen typically when individuals with high IQ scores mate. Their children tend to show lower scores than their parents. The converse happens for low IQ parents. They have children with somewhat higher IQs. This is because the parents pass on some, but not all, of their exceptional genes to their offspring. It is analogous to rolling a pair of dice and having them come up with two sixes or two ones. The odds are that on the next roll, you'll get some value that's not quite as high or as low. Genetic theory predicts the precise magnitude of the regression effect. Culture-only theory makes no systematic or quantitative predictions. Black children with parents of IQ of 115 regress to the black IQ average of 85, while white children with parents of IQ 115 regress to the white IQ average of 100. Regression to a lower average IQ helps to explain the fact that black children born to high IQ, wealthy black parents have test scores 2 to 4 points lower than do white children born to low IQ, poor white parents. Number four, the gene environment architecture of IQ is the same in all races. Studies of black, white, and East Asian twins show that the heritability of IQ is about the same in all races, 50% or higher. There has been no indication of any special cultural influences, such as extreme deprivation or being raised as a visible minority, being at work in one group and not in the others. A strong genetic contribution is also indicated by black-white differences being most pronounced on the most heritable components of tests. Number five, brain size differences. Larger brains are more intelligent because they contain more neurons and synapses and can process information more efficiently, just as in computer chips. 24 studies using magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, have shown that brain size is related to IQ differences within a race with a correlation of about 0.40. As I have already described, studies of race differences in brain size are highly reliable. They have been confirmed using four independent procedures: MRI, endocranial volume from empty skulls, wet brain weight at autopsy, and external head size measurements. Number six, transracial adoption studies. Average race differences remain despite adoption of blacks by white middle-class parents. This has been demonstrated by a number of surveys, notably the Minnesota Transracial Adoption Study, as I have described earlier in this chapter. Number 7, racial admixture studies. Dozens of studies have found that lighter-skinned African-Americans and the mixed-race coloreds of South Africa, the term used for the mixed-race population there, who are also lighter-skinned, have average IQs between those of unmixed groups of blacks and whites. The colored population of South Africa has an average IQ of 85, intermediate to the respective African and white averages of 70 and 100. The IQ of blacks in the United States, around 85, is substantially higher than the IQ of blacks in sub-Saharan Africa. There are two explanations for this. The first is that American blacks have about 25% white ancestry. According to genetic theory, this would raise their IQs above the level of blacks in Africa. And the second is that American blacks enjoy much higher standards of living, nutrition, education, and health care than they do in societies run by blacks, such as in Africa. Living in a white society has raised rather than lowered the IQ of American blacks. Between those two differences, greater numbers of white genes and the better conditions, they score higher than their African brothers in Africa. Number 8, race differences are seen over a wide range of issues. East Asians and blacks fall at the two ends of a continuum. Whites are in the middle. In addition to brain size and IQ, this shows up on a suite of 60 other life history variables. They include speed of maturation and longevity, personality and temperament, family stability and crime, and sexual behavior and fertility. One striking example, around the world, the rate of diszygotic, in other words, two-egg twinning, is less than 4 per 1,000 births among East Asians. It's about 8 among whites and about 16 or greater among blacks. The tendency to produce dizygotic twins is heritable and mediated by sex hormones. Another example, black babies sit, crawl, walk, and put on their clothes earlier than whites or East Asians. For walking, East Asians 13 months, whites 12 months, blacks 11 months. Blacks also have an earlier age of sexual maturity than do whites, who in turn have an earlier age than do East Asians, whether measured by the age of first menstruation, first sexual experience, or first pregnancy. Number 9, race differences and human origins research. The fact that the three-way pattern in IQ, brain size, and other traits is not unique to the United States, but occurs internationally, is consistent with a single genetic evolutionary theory such as the Out of Africa theory. This posits that Homo sapiens arose in Africa about 150,000 years ago and then expanded northward beyond Africa about 100,000 years ago with a European-East Asian split about 41,000 years ago. Evolutionary selection pressures were different in the hot savanna where Africans lived than in the cold northern regions Europeans experienced, or even the colder Arctic regions of East Asians. Thus, the further north the ancestral human populations migrated out of Africa about 100,000 years ago, the more they encountered the cognitively demanding problems of gathering and storing food, gaining shelter, making clothes, and raising children successfully during harsh and prolonged winters. As these populations evolved into present-day East Asians and Europeans, the ecological pressures selected for larger brains, slower rates of maturation, and lower levels of sex hormone, and all the other life history characteristics. Number 10, culture-only theory hypotheses fail to account for the race IQ differences. Culture-only theories do not explain the race differences in IQ. The concept that black-white IQ differences are due to differences in socioeconomic status does not survive close examination. Adjusting for socioeconomic status only reduces the black-white IQ difference by about one-third. Massive society-wide interventions such as ending segregation, the subsequent nationwide program of school busing to achieve racial balance in education, and the Head Start programs have failed to reduce the differences. Head Start programs did produce modest gains in school retention and graduation rates among whites, but not blacks. The narrowing of the gap between black-white social conditions has not led to any change in the magnitude of the black-white IQ difference over the last 100 years. Once I learned that the primary determinant of racial differences is heredity rather than environment, the genetic differences should show up in the physiology of the brains of the different races. So my next focus was to explore the research on the physical differences between the races. If the primary determinant of racial differences is heredity rather than environment, then genetic differences should show up in the physiology of the brains of the different races. So my next focus was to explore the research on the physical differences between the races. I do that in my next chapter, which is chapter 8, and that's titled The Roots of Racial Difference. Again, I must tell everyone listening, this is a free audio program, and I hope all of you are enjoying it, but I urge you to support this work and this time and this effort that I've gone through doing this book and doing this work, to support this effort by purchasing the book and getting copies for your friends of this great book. Also, you'll find an exhaustive index which will enable you to research issues. A very fine aspect of the book is the fact that it's footnoted thoroughly. There's over 1,000 footnotes. So every major study, every major statement I make in the book is backed up by citations, research citations, so you yourself can get the original data or check the original data to see that what I'm saying here is not just simply made up of whole cloth, but is actual scientific fact and knowledge. As you can see, the facts are overwhelming, and you're discovering in this audio program that really the public is not and has not been informed on these issues as they should be. The media has done a hell of a job to deceive the public about not only differences in race, but even the nature of intelligence and civilization, the nature of intelligence testing and its predictive power in education and society. And these are very vital issues, and these are the most fundamental issues upon which a society, a civilization, a culture rests. Without this knowledge, how in the world are we going to solve the problems of society? And in upcoming chapters, I'm going to talk about how these facts clearly dovetail with the realities that we see in society. For instance, I talk a lot here about black rates in terms of marriage in the next chapter, and we talk later about the illegitimacy rates throughout the entire world where black populations exist. What are the patterns of marriage and family and the sexual patterns between the races? So anyway, the next chapter again, which you'll be able to hear almost immediately, is chapter 8, The Roots of Racial Difference.